From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Question: are you a rugged individualist or an interwoven part of a larger community? Do you look to your neighbors for harmonious living, or do you make your own decisions despite the consequences? Your response may lie in the answer to this question. Did your ancestors grow rice or wheat? Thomas Talhelm is a social psychologist at the University of Virginia, where he studies how rice and wheat agriculture have given way to two distinct cultures and philosophies. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What are the characteristics that seem to be quite pronounced in Eastern versus Western culture?
From a cultural standpoint, yeah. So Western cultures tend to be more individualistic. You have a focus on uniqueness. Relationships tend to be easier to form, but the downside to that is that they're also easier to break. In places like China and Japan, relationships are often slower to build. More oftentimes, they're based on these sort of connections that last over a long time. So I taught high school in a city in China called Guangzhou, and my students there were in the same class. Same classroom literally all day for all the years of their high school. And so they become really good friends with the people around them. Whereas if you contrast that with where I went to high school, I was in a different classroom every class of the day, and we had making new friends and losing old friends, and you have a much more sort of looser social network.
So is it when you were living there that you really started to focus in on the differences?
That's right, yeah. So I first was sent to a city in southern China called Guangzhou, and I was teaching high school there for a year. And I would notice things like when I was in the supermarket. You know, it's a big city. The aisles are fairly small. It can be crowded. Sometimes people would bump into me. And I would notice when they would bump into me, they would oftentimes sort of tense up and look at the floor and shuffle away quietly without saying anything. And it seemed to me that there was a focus on avoiding conflict. A few months later, I moved up to the north of China, and Beijing is in the north, and I just started noticing different behaviors right away. One of the first things I noticed was I was at a museum with another American friend of mine. We were talking to an employee at the museum, and she said, "Wow, your Chinese is very good." But she said, "But your Chinese," and she pointed at me, "is better than your Chinese," and she pointed at my roommate. And we were we were stunned, and it such sensitivity about whose Chinese is better, and we don't want to compare ourselves like that. But it seemed to me like people in the North were a little bit more sort of freewheeling, outgoing, sort of lay it all out there, but a little bit less concerned about how what they say might affect our relationships.
So what was the leap for you that made you start look at farming and differences in farming?
That's right, because there's really two different things there. There's northern and southern culture in China are very different, and lots of Chinese people know about that. It's not really a discovery to say that there are different cultures. But the second part of it is, why are they different? And my theory is that it's because the South has been growing rice for thousands of years and the North has been growing wheat. It actually started, this is a bit of a wonky story, but I was in a class on dialects in Beijing. And in this class, we were looking at a map of a very small sort of dialectical difference. There's a character in Chinese that it's called shou, and it can mean hand in some places, in other places it means arm. And you could say, well, what does that have to do with anything? But our professor showed us a map of different places where it means hand and where it means arm. It really split almost cleanly across the Yangtze River. The Yangtze River splits China into the north and into the south. And basically, north of there, it meant hand. South of there, it meant arm. And I thought, this is a dividing line. Culture sort of resides within language communities. And I thought, there's got to be something about that river. There's got to be something special that's dividing. And it turns out that that's more or less the dividing line between where people have been farming rice and where they've been farming wheat.
So let's talk about that, because the Western world, including us, were such a wheat farming culture. So what are the differences culturally in the agriculture?
Yeah, I focus on two things. First is that rice requires paddy rice requires irrigation networks. So these are systems to put water into the fields and then to get water out of the fields once it's time to harvest the crop. Those systems lead to very important things. It means that we have to coordinate our water use, and a lot of times it means we have to fill and drain our fields at the same time. So I can't just do my own thing. Us successfully planting this crop depends on us coordinating our water use. use. So that's a big thing that leads to very functional interdependence. I'm not talking about pie in the sky, we all love each other. I mean, we need to work together to put food on the table. The second thing is that rice requires a lot of work because of all this movement of water, because they also have to transplant from seed beds into the field. This takes a lot of time. So rice farmers on average have to spend twice the number of hours as wheat farmers in the fields. And so why this is important is because rice farmers, to deal with that labor burden, will form cooperative labor exchanges. So I'll help you farm your plot this week, and then you'll help me farm my plot next week. And that really links people together in these sort of tight reciprocal relationships.
And in contrast, wheat farming is not about irrigation and large amounts of labor.
That's right. So, I mean, certainly there's a lot of labor in wheat farming as well, and I would hate to take that away from any of our ancestors. But when anthropologists have visited pre-modern rice and wheat villages, they'll find on average that wheat requires about half the amount of labor as rice. And in fact, you can find these old farming texts, farming guides in China from, say, the 1600s that say, you know, if you're short of labor, if you have, for example, an injury or in poor health, you should farm wheat in your field instead of rice. So people were aware of that difference.
Wow. So fascinating. So do you have any psychological or societal predictions for the future based on rice theory?
You know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, how long are these differences going to last, right? You know, 50, 100 years ago, everybody was farming, or most everybody was actually farming rice and wheat in China. A lot of my participants in the studies had actually never farmed rice or wheat. They're college students mostly. But their parents, a lot of them really have, or their parents or their grandparents. So the question becomes, in 50 and 100 years, when these participants have children, what are their children going to be like? They're not going to be directly connected to the farm. So on the one hand, we might expect these cultures to change. But on the other hand, culture, you know, it has an inertia to it. It doesn't change overnight. And there's some research in the United States linking regional differences within the United States to the subsistence style that people had when they came over. So for example, parts of Appalachia in the United States were settled by people from herding cultures. And in herding cultures, you have this more of a need to sort of be tough and to protect your property. Cattle rustling is a big problem. Whereas for a wheat farmer, you know, you don't wake up in the middle of the night and find somebody, you know, reaping the wheat in your field, you know. So it's easier to steal the property of a herding family. And what research has found is that herding cultures tend to have more of a sort of a culture of honor. Like if you step on my toes, then I'm going to have to defend myself. And you find higher rates of violence that are linked to that. Now, these regions in the United States were settled by herding cultures several hundred years ago. And yet psychologists are still finding these differences. That research was done in the 1990s. So if those differences can last 200 years in the United States, you know, who's to say they won't last that long in China?
Wow, this has been so interesting. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Thomas Talhelm. His research shows the different personalities of rice and wheat farming communities. Coming up, have you ever taken a bite of Cool Whip or Easy Cheese and thought, what on earth did I just put in my mouth? My next guest did, and he wrote a book. It's called This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. Stay with us.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. Looking at Earth from space, you'd never guess that less than 1% of that beautiful blue surface water is usable as fresh drinking water. Many countries are already looking at how sanitation projects can help water shortages, so-called toilet-to-tap projects, like the Omniprocessor, a project funded by the Gates Foundation. Human waste is turned into drinking water within minutes. Unfortunately, photos of Bill Gates sipping from a glass may not be quite enough to get us to drink this stuff. Paul Rosen says it's psychologists, not scientists, who are going to have to convince us to drink it. As a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, he's pioneered modern research on disgust. Hi there.
Hello.
So I find it just fascinating that now the problem isn't the actual technology of making the recycled water, but it's all about getting people to drink it. So you conducted a series of studies. Were any of your subjects comfortable with drinking recycled water?
Oh, quite a few subjects. These are American adults from five cities around the United States. And yes, many of them were willing to try it. We told them that it was totally safe and that it was actually virtually pure water. It's purer than most tap water.
So how many of them were squeamish?
Well, actually, the majority, the biggest number were people who were uncomfortable, but they thought they might be convinced. There is a group of less than 20% that say that they'll never do it, no matter what you do to the water. It's just a big no. That's what they say. Now, we don't know what they would do if they had very little choice. The answer is, of course, they would drink it if there was very little choice.
So you talk about the psychological phenomenon known as contagion and framing. What are those?
Well, contagion is we're talking about psychological contagion now, not about microbial contagion, though they're related. This is a belief that is universal in humans, that if something of a certain sort, something disgusting, suddenly touches something else, it passes its properties to it. So the way we do it in the laboratory, if we drop a cockroach in a favored juice, take the cockroach out, there's no cockroach visible there, people won't drink the juice. And even if we boil the juice, for some people, even if we boil the juice, if we sterilize the cockroach, it doesn't matter. For some people, it's an indelible effect. For other people, you can wash it away by, you know, either boiling the juice or something. So we did this study in a questionnaire form with people. We asked them, okay, here's this recycled water. You won't drink it. How about, suppose we took some sewer water and we boiled it and we took the evaporation, right, the water that evaporated, and we condensed that and we had that in a glass. Would you drink that? And most people aren't too comfortable with that. That would be pure water. That would be actually better than the water you normally drink. But, you know, it was just sewer water. And the idea is that its contact with that sewage has permeated it. So we have to get around that in order to promote bottled water, or at least get enough people to not worry about it. But you see, all water is toilet to tap.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the water that you're drinking right now from your faucet or from a bottled water comes from ultimately a reservoir or a stream or a spring. And how did that water get there? Well, somebody flushed their toilet and the water eventually went out into the ocean and it evaporated and then it came down as rain in a mountain somewhere or whatever, and then it went into a stream and then it was, you know, captured by a water processing plant. So the only difference between recycled water and normal drinking water is the time it took for those molecules to get back into your drinking water.
So distance and time, do they reduce the objections to drinking recycled water?
Yes. In general, for there are some people who claim that they won't drink it no matter how long you store it, no matter how far it travels. So there's an indelible effect. But, of course, they should stop drinking all water because all water is contaminated. A colleague of mine, Robert Gigignac, who's a geologist, actually calculated for me that if you're in Europe and you drink a glass of water, you will drink at least a few molecules of water that went through Adolf Hitler. You know, that's the way the world is. Water mixes. That isn't true here yet because it takes 2,000 years for water to equilibrate around the world. But we're drinking Moses, and that's fine, you know. But I'm just saying that, you see, all of our water is contaminated. The question is how much attention we pay to that. You sit in the theater next to a person you don't know, and you're breathing the air they just breathed out. Right? No question about that. Now, if they went over to you and breathed right in your mouth, you'd be very offended. But, you know, it's just right next to you, and you get used to it. Because the whole world, we're all breathing used air, and we're all drinking used water. And it's just a question of whether it's called to our attention. And toilet to tap calls it to your attention.
So let's talk about Singapore. Let's talk about Singapore, where recycled water has made great strides. What criteria influenced that acceptance?
Well, first of all, we have to start with the fact that Singapore is water short. So there is economic and political reasons to generate your own water. If they have to get water from another country, typically Malaysia, they sometimes have touchy relations with Malaysia. They don't want to be dependent. So you have a motive, okay? Like there's a motive in the American Southwest because they can't get enough water. Now, the government of Singapore is an autocratic democracy. You know, they're elected, but the same people get elected all the time, pretty much. There's only one level of government, so they don't have all these, you know, state, county, federal regulations. Now, they don't just impose a solution. They've done it very cleverly. They've gone on a major effort to get people used to it. I've been to this. They made a beautiful processing facility, which people can tour. When they go through the tour, they're given bottles of the recycled water in, like water, standard water bottles. It's called New Water, N-E-W-A-T-E-R. They can bring it home. They'll provide it for you if you're having an affair for free. And they're gradually introducing this into the groundwater. They're not introducing it directly into the faucet. So it's a gradual process. People are getting used to it. And, you know, just like you get used to the breathing used there in the theater or sitting in a chair that many other people have sat in on a train, you get used to this. It becomes part of your life and you don't even think about it.
This has been really interesting. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Paul Rozin's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's been pioneering modern research on disgust. So you find the idea of recycled water disturbing? Well, what about cockroach pheromones or artificial rotting meat odor? Yes, we put food in our mouths every day that isn't quite what it seems. Patrick DeGiusto wrote the popular Wired magazine column, What's Inside? He now asks the question, this is what you just put in your mouth? The title of his new book. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, how are you?
Do you remember the first ingredient breakdown you did of a food that you actually ate?
Oh, of course. The first one, it was inspired by a Super Bowl party that we were having. A friend of mine looked at the can of Easy Cheese, you know, that aerosol spray-on cheese, looked at it and said, you know, does anyone really know what's inside this? And that started the whole process. And that October, we ran that first article on what's inside a can of Easy Cheese.
So since in the previous segment, we were talking a lot about tap water.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to talk about that because we think about tap water as being sort of a null set, you know, something that's just, you know, it comes to us, it's empty. But in fact, it isn't empty, is it?
It is loaded with all sorts of stuff. And the wonderful thing about tap water is that it's local. So that your tap water is different from my tap water, which is different from someone else's tap water. Each one of them has their own little idiosyncrasies. A lot of it is based on the actual geology of where you live. For example, in Houston, the tap water in general tends to have a slightly higher percentage of radioactive particles. Why is that? Because the ground around Houston is naturally slightly more radioactive than most places in the United States. So they have to filter for that. They have to, you know, be very careful to remove those before it actually gets to the tap. Water in other places may have different mineral components that need to be watched for. Sometimes your tap water has to be watched because of the way the tap water is treated.
What do you mean by that?
Most places will treat their tap water with chlorine, and that's very good for killing bacteria, things like that. Some places will treat their tap water with ammonia, which is very good for killing bacteria and things like that. A very few places actually mix the two, which if you look on any of your household cleaning products, the bleach products say do not mix with ammonia, and the ammonia products say do not mix with bleach. Some places mix the two, which is a super, super duper bacteria cleaning and killing agent. Unfortunately, if you drink too much of it, it's also a people killing agent. So they have to be very careful to remove that from their water supply.
Wow. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about something we all love to eat. Maybe something that's chocolate-based.
Such as chocolate-covered cherry cordials?
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Absolutely wonderful. These are these little magical candies that contain a maraschino cherry inside a syrupy liquid, which is inside a chocolate covering. And the question always is, how do they actually get the liquid inside the chocolate? Some places do it the simple way. I think it's called cheating, where they will make a little cup of chocolate. They'll put the cherry in, they'll put the syrup in, then they'll put a lid on it, and there's your answer. Most other places, though, don't like the seam that results from that. They want a flawless candy. So what they do is they take a cherry, they completely coat it in sugar, then they spray saliva enzymes onto that sugar. Then they run that through this Willy Wonka chocolate waterfall to completely coat the sugar bullet with chocolate so it doesn't leave a seam. They package that up and they bring it to the store. While it sits on the store shelves, the saliva enzyme breaks down the sugar into a sugar syrup. So that at the end of a couple of days, when you go and buy it, you take it, you bite into it, and there is a cherry inside sugar syrup, inside a seamless chocolate coating. How did they do it? That's how they did it.
So it's as if somebody else is sucking on the inside of the candy, waiting for you.
Well, here's the great thing. To be totally fair, it is not human saliva. It is an enzyme that comes from yeast. Yeast that we use in bread, yeast that you would use in beer. It's the same enzyme, which happens to be absolutely identical to human spit.
You know, I do understand that everything around us can be looked at through a chemistry lens.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, over the past 8 years that you've been breaking down the chemical compositions of foods and cleaning supplies, cosmetics, do you now view the world as one huge chemical assault, or do you feel that there's enough of the natural world of chemistry that it isn't super scary?
Oh, no. It is definitely not a chemical assault, even with the exception of maybe Cool Whip. Just about anything you eat is mostly natural, with maybe some additional chemicals. And for the most part, anything you want to eat, you can almost always find a low chemical variation of it.
Well, that makes me feel better. But let's talk about that Cool Whip.
Because this is probably the most unnatural food that you will eat. It's as if, I don't know, space aliens wanted to create whipped cream without ever having tasted whipped cream, but just knowing the chemical formula of it.
How odd. What are some of the highlights of the chemical composition?
Essentially, what you're doing is you're recreating cream without actually using any cream. So they're adding things like hydrogenated coconut and palm kernel oil, which is about as healthy for you to eat as Elmer's glue. You've got corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup, which is, again, not really a great thing for you to be eating. My personal favorite is polysorbate 60. These are sugar alcohols. They are used as emulsifiers to keep everything smooth and flowing, which is why you also find them in some sexual lubricants. You've got sodium cationate, which is actually one of the few milk products actually found in Cool Whip. It has had almost all of its milk ancestry removed, and it's just pure protein, in addition to things like guar gum to make it just a little bit thick, sodium monostearate, which is synthetic wax, by the way, because you need something to actually help the whipped product hold its shape.
Patrick, this has been so fun, and I love going through the book. It's just really fun to try and figure out how to pronounce all these things.
Thank you. It's been great.
That was Patrick DeGiusto. His new book is This Is What You Just Put in Your Mouth. It's such a great book, really fun to flip through and read. Jonathan Gold's in the studio next when Goodford returns. Plus, a pastry chef tells us the secret to his perfect cannelé de Bordeaux. Stay close.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's time for Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. He's here with this week's restaurant recommendation. Today, we're off to the Silicon Beach area of Venice.
We're going to Giusta, the delicious and very controversial new restaurant.
It's a food hall, really.
It's a food hall, or it's a delicatessen, or it's a coffee shop, or it's a juice bar. Nobody can quite figure it out. What it isn't apparently at the moment, though it acts like one, is a restaurant because they don't have any chairs.
Or tables, really.
Or tables.
There are some handy little milk crates you can turn over and sit on.
You can sit on some milk crates outside, or there's the coffee bar has a really, really long counter, so you can sit at that, and they have, I think, a plank built into a wall.
What is the controversy?
The controversy probably has to do with parking, like almost everything in Los Angeles does, and there's not enough of it. So their license at the moment is only as a bakery. It's not as a restaurant. So I've never found it a problem to find a place to eat there. But you'd be astonished at the amount of letters I got from people in the neighborhood when the review ran a couple weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they were upset that you were telling people about it?
Because they were residents who had parking issues.
Well, I can imagine. In Venice, it's not easy.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them were also sort of beefing about gentrification, which, considering it's around the corner from Google and across from Gold's Gin.
That ship has sailed so long ago.
Yeah.
So what kind of food are we looking at here?
If you go in there and you walk in, there's a lot of bread and baked goods when you first get in that I imagine were first the project of Nicole Rucker before she left. They have a croissant filled with baklava stuff. It's a baklava croissant, which is delicious. And they do a controversial bialy because it's nothing like what somebody raised in the Lower East Side would consider bialy. But when it's filled with actually decidedly California ingredients, right? I mean, house smoked salmon and you can get cream cheese or you can get, say, house-made labneh flavored with za'atar and, you know, chopped vegetables and a handful of alfalfa sprouts to top it off. And it sounds like something that would be a nightmare of a sandwich, but it's really good.
So good. So good. It's like there's all these different sections. There's the smoked fish section, which is just you could take out a bank loan, but so good.
Yeah. If you ask nicely, they'll put together sort of a mixed plate. So you can get the smoked salmon. You can get the pastrami salmon. It's not that pastrami-ish, but it's there. They have both smoked herring and pickled herring. They have, you know, a bunch of stuff.
And in addition to that, they also have rotisserie items.
Right. You can go in there and buy a whole chicken, take it home. I guess it's the West Side's answer to Zanku.
One of the hallmarks of Giusta seems to be the wandering around trying to figure out who's going to take your order or how you go about ordering from so many different areas.
Yeah. If you're going in for the first time or even really for the fifth time, you walk in, you see all the stuff. The menus are spread out over what must be 30 yards. And you just stand there with your mouth open. But it won't take long before somebody will notice your plight and sort of guide you through it. It's like almost like having a personal shopper at a department store.
Yeah, they kind of interview you along the way so they can hone in on what your tastes are.
And they'll take your coffee order or your juice order. They'll get the pastry. They'll get the bread to go.
It's really good bread.
Sort of almost like half burnt in a way that nobody quite does here, and really crusty, and it's good bread. And somehow you get your lunch together and you stand at the coffee counter and your cortado appears and your sandwich appears and your salads. There's a whole deli case of salads, some of which are really good. I like the one of cauliflower in a vinaigrette with like capers and garlic and olives. And it's sort of like cauliflower Putin-esque almost. It's delicious.
Did you get any of the sandwiches?
Yeah, I got most of them, I think. Not at once. Again, if you're going for authenticity, this is probably not your place. But they do, I guess you'd call it a hero, though they don't call it a hero, with freshly roasted porchetta and a thing of fontina cheese and some condiments. And it's greasy and the baguette is double burnt on its way to you. And it's crunchy and juicy and kind of glorious in its way.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Giusta in Venice. Text the words good food to 69866 to get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. The Cannelé de Bordeaux is a strange little pastry with a passionate fan base. It's not too sweet. It has two distinct textures, and it looks so odd, both formal and rustic at the same time. To plumb the intricacies of making them, we turn to Chris Harvey, the executive pastry chef for SLS, which of course includes The Bazaar by José Andrés.
Thanks for having me.
We're so excited about this.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad to be here.
So describe the perfect cannelé.
You know, the perfect cannelé de Bordeaux is one that is uniformly colored on the outside and very dark in color. The saying in France is the bun isn't done until it's black. I like mine to look like the color of the copper mold that I've used. And you should only use copper. You shouldn't use silicone or aluminum. And those are available, but those are useless. They don't attract the heat like copper does. So it has to be very dark on the outside. They should be 70 grams in total weight, and they should have a soft custardy interior. And Condé Nast magazine came by my restaurant years ago, and I gave them. I wasn't selling them at this point. I was just giving them away because I was still under the testing phase of them. And one of their journalists described them as portable creme brulees, and that's what they taste like. You know, they have a deep vanilla flavor. It's important to use a nice, dark, mature rum. In this case, I use rum from Austria called Stroh. And it's unusual to get rum from Austria because they don't have sugar cane there. But it has this wonderful butter and vanilla flavor to it. So it kind of really adds something to it versus some of the other clear rums on the market. The vanilla we use is important. We used a vanilla from Bora Bora, Grand Cru, and it's almost $500 a kilogram. So it's about $250 a pound. And they're beautiful, thick, and really kind of sticky vanilla beans and very fragrant. And we use beautiful salted butter from Vermont, and we put a lot of love into it. And, you know, we only bake 12 a day.
Now, why is this? I know also that up at Boulette's Larder in San Francisco that Amarel's only making 12 a day.
You know, I don't know why they do it, but here's why I do it. I treat it like Ferrari, and I'm a car guy. I love cars. I don't have a Ferrari. I wish I did. But Ferrari always makes one less than the market demands. So those guys will sit around a room, and they're going to say, they say, let's make 400 of this model, the F60, and somebody in the room will say, let's make 399, and that's where they stop it. And so that was kind of my philosophy. I do have 24 molds, and we can do much more, but I'm not ready to do it. We like to increase its value by only making 12, And they sell out every night.
The history of the Canelet is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and a little clouded, too. They started popping up in Paris around 1998, 1999. And I was already in the profession for about 8 years at this point. And it was, you know, very mysterious, this Canelet de Bordeaux. And by the way, people mispronounce it all the time. They say canel, which is cinnamon in French. So it's a very similar spelling, but it is Canelet. And this regional item that was only available in Bordeaux started popping up at high-end pastry shops. And Pierre Hermé was one of the ones that was doing it. And he was pastry chef at La Durée at this point. He had left Fauchon and was doing it at La Durée. And these people were offended in Bordeaux, so they said, this is not happening. We're going to change the spelling, and we're going to determine the size, the dosage, and the bake time of this. And anybody spells it C-A-N-N-E-L-E-S versus C-A-N-E-L-E, you can tell them that it's a phony. And that's what they did. They started the society. They held hands and made a border, and they stick by it. So in that respect, I spell mine not the way they spell it in Bordeaux, out of respect for their history.
So let's talk about making them. First, explain the molds.
Well, the molds have to be copper and 70 grams. They do make larger ones, and they make smaller ones in copper. But I have found, you know, when you eat a Reese's peanut butter cup and then you eat a little mini Reese's peanut butter cup, they're completely different animals. It's not that one's better. You know, they're both good, but there's that ratio is different of the peanut butter filling to chocolate filling, and they taste different. And I think the Canelet is about that too. It's if they're smaller, you have less crumb and more crust, and you don't get that great dual bite that you can get out of a 70-gram Canelet de Bordeaux. So it's important that you use copper molds. It's important that they're well-seasoned. And I look for a specific brand. There's a company called Matt Fair. They're a French company, but they're based out of the San Fernando Valley, believe it or not. I use theirs because they have a little sharper edging than some of the other ones. They're a little bit more rounded. And it's a more sharper-looking Canelet when it's finished. But seasoning them in a hot oven for several days at a time is the first step. Never washing them is important.
When you're seasoning them, do you use the wax at that point?
Not yet. That's the second step. So they go into a dry oven, and they just cook and cook and cook for hours. And then I hit them with a blowtorch and flame them for a little bit longer. And then you can start putting the beeswax in. And you only really need a little bit of beeswax when you start making them. But you do need a lot to get them seasoned.
So let's talk about the beeswax, because people are going to be, what are you doing with the beeswax? So the beeswax is instead of the spray.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't even know what's in that spray. So we know what's in beeswax. And there's a couple of beeswax varieties that you want. You want to use one that's a natural beeswax that has not been deodorized, because you can go to an art supply store and get like clear beeswax and it has no aroma to it. I like the cloudy beeswax. As a matter of fact, if you can get it from a farmer, and here in California, we can get it from farmers, and they don't even know what you want to do with it. They look at you like you're crazy.
When you're applying it to the inside of the mold, are you using a brush or are you pouring
it
in?
We get it hot with a blowtorch, and then we pour it in, and we take tweezers, and we turn it around and around and around, and we dump it out. And you really shouldn't be able to see but just a little thin film of beeswax. And if you have too much, it actually lifts the Canelet out, and that's how you get a bell-shaped Canelet, which you do not want. You want it to rise and then go back down into the mold. And it will rise a little bit because it has eggs in it. And then when it goes down, you know you're on the right path to getting a perfect Canelet de Bordeaux.
Now, are we going to add wax every time?
Every time.
Okay, so let's talk about the batter.
So day one, we take the vanilla bean and we split it and we warm it up in the milk. We don't boil it. We just warm it up. We take it to about 90 degrees centigrade. And then we wrap it up tight and we create a vacuum. So it's just like making a cup of tea. You want it to be covered and get your strong infusion. And that goes in the cooler and it sits overnight. So it's a hot and cold infusion. And then day two, we start the mix process. And the first thing that goes in the milk at this point is cold salted butter. And then we warm that up to about 90 degrees centigrade. And then we follow the progression of sifted powdered sugar, sifted flour, eggs and egg yolks at room temperature, and then the mature rum. So it first goes into the powdered sugar, and we whisk it so there's no lumps, and then we quickly whisk that into the flour. A little lump is okay because it's like crepe batter. And then we put it into the eggs and the egg yolks, and we mix it very gently. And you're going to see some streaks of eggs and egg yolks in it. It's okay because it has to absorb the flour and then the rum goes in, and that kind of mellows out the eggs and the egg yolks. So then it sits one more day, and the next day we take it out, we mix it gently, and then we strain it through a chinois, a fine mesh sieve, and then we give it a gentle mix every time we take it out of the fridge.
How important is that maturing of the batter at least overnight?
Well, it's extremely important. It's like making crepe batter. If you utilize crepe batter the minute you make it, the crepes are not going to hold together. So here we build the structure of the absorption of all the dry ingredients with the wet ingredients. And actually, the batter gets better over 5 days. You know, if I could go 5 days, we weren't so busy, I'd let it sit 5 days, you know.
When I look at the interior of a cannelé, I really see what the gluten has given to the product. Is it possible to make a gluten-free cannelé?
You know, somebody follows me on Instagram, and they asked me for that. And I just, you know, I'm gluten-free myself, you know, but I would not disrespect. I have so much respect for the tradition of pastry, and I have tremendous respect for the people that have come before me, that I would not disrespect the cannelé de Bordeaux by going gluten-free with it. I was just in Vienna and Brussels and Paris, and I took a pill to help me digest the gluten, and it worked. And so I would recommend anybody take this and just kind of deal with it. It's amazing. We can smell them right now. Can you smell them from where you're sitting?
Yeah, I'm ready to stop talking and start eating.
Yeah, I recommend it.
Thank you so much. This has been really wonderful.
I'm glad you like it. Hopefully you like the cannelé.
That was Chris Harvey. He's executive pastry chef for the SLS Hotel, which of course includes the Bazaar by Jose Andres. He only makes 12 of these delicious cannelé a day, and they are offered at dinner service only, both at the Bazaar and the Pâtisserie. Stick around. The Market Report is next, right here on Good Food.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Many of us jump into the Pacific for play. We surf and we swim and splash, but way out there in our own briny blue, an experiment has been taking place. It's an experiment in not fishing, and it might change forever the way fisheries are managed. Writer and sports fisherman Paul Greenberg recently jumped into our ocean to see for himself how not fishing can change everything. His piece, The Fisherman's Dilemma, was co-produced with the Food and Environment Reporting Network for the California Sunday Magazine. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
Great. This is just such a fascinating piece that you wrote. Could you describe the system that was once the Pacific coastal area?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Pacific coast was once this sort of giant kelp forest. We can't even really begin to imagine what an incredibly verdant and productive ecosystem it was. And it was an interconnected thing. I mean, there were sea otters, which were very, very abundant, which in turn ate abalone, which in turn ate kelp. And by having otters there and abalone there and kelp and sea urchins and also many, many fish that use the kelp forest, there was this sort of checks and balance set up where you had an extremely productive ecosystem, rich in fish, rich in shellfish, and rich in otters.
And this was a system that went all the way from the southern tip of Baja all the way up to the south end of British Columbia.
Yeah. And in fact, there are some people who hypothesize that actually the kelp forest wound around Asia and that it constituted what one academic called a kelp highway. And so that possibly some of the original colonization that occurred of the California Pacific happened because Aboriginal people were able to kind of hop along kelp forests, foraging all the way down around the corner up near British Columbia and coming down all the way down south into Southern California.
Wow. So what happened to this ecosystem?
Well, you know, California is a real boom and bust kind of state, and it was from the very beginning. And the very first boom and bust was sea otters. Sea otter pelt has millions of hairs per square inch, which makes it extremely warm and extremely valuable if you don't have anything else to keep you warm. So they were a tremendously important commodity when California first started getting opened up. Well, of course, when you find a real rich commodity like sea otters, you can really overexploit them very quickly. And by 1850, pretty much all the sea otters were gone. But that caused this kind of cascading effect where you had then abalone and sea urchins really boom because no one was eating them. And unfortunately, what abalone and sea urchins both eat is kelp. So the kelp started to kind of fall apart. Meanwhile, then you had another boom and bust. You had Chinese immigrants coming in and starting to harvest the abalone and exporting that back to China. And of course, then the abalone was overexploited. And then finally, the last wave, which we're sort of currently in, is finfish. And, you know, we've seen mounting fishing pressure occur in California throughout the last century, which culminated in kind of a big bust in the late 1990s.
And a lot of this exploitation started as a result of what happened in 1983, the 200-mile sovereignty.
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that I've returned to again and again. I wrote a book earlier this year called American Catch, which sort of looks at why it is that, you know, 90% of the seafood we eat in this country is imported. Well, one of the major reasons is that around 1976, a law called the Magnuson-Stevens Act was passed, and then it, as you say, went into effect in 83, which extended national sovereignty out to 200 miles, or I should say an exclusive economic zone, or EEZ. Well, you would think, you know, once we pushed all those foreign vessels out of our waters and were able to claim all that, you would think, oh, okay, well, now we'll have be able to adjust fishing pressure, et cetera. But actually, we did the opposite. We built up the American fishing fleet to a tremendous degree. We subsidized it through fuel, through amortization of vessels. And so we were really overcapitalized by the time the mid-90s came along. And that caused, you know, surprise, overfishing.
So now let's talk about this reserve. How much of California fisheries has been set aside, and where is it?
Okay. Well, so it's not just a single reserve. It's several networks of marine protected areas, which is really what makes California unique. Many countries out there and many states have individual reserves, but California has networks. And the goal was, and what they've achieved is, they've put 16% of state-controlled waters into some sort of reserve where fishing is either highly restricted or eliminated altogether. Now, important point, that's state waters. Like, remember I was saying that we extended our jurisdiction out to 200 nautical miles? Well, states own their waters out to about 3 nautical miles. From 3 to 200 nautical miles, the feds own it, or the feds control it. So meanwhile, while California fishermen were subject to all of these state closures, they were also subject to very serious federal closures. There was this area created in the early 2000s called the Rockfish Conservation Area in federal waters. So can you imagine if you're a fishing captain and you're used to kind of fishing in state, fishing in federal, blah, 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 suddenly you've got state closures, then you've got federal closures, then you've got essential habitat closures. It's very difficult to be a California fisherman these days.
So is the reserve working?
So is the reserve network working?
Yes.
Or are the reserve networks working? So it's a little early, but in the Channel Islands, which is the network that we have the longest data set for because it was the earliest network created, they're definitely finding more and bigger fish. And remember, a very important thing about these reserves is they tend to facilitate the growth of what are called BOFs. And a BOF stands for a big old fat female fish. Very, very scientific term there. But a BOF is really important reproductively because the big old fat female fish have more eggs and they also turn out to have more viable eggs. Outside the reserves, it seems we are also seeing some spillover effect. We're also seeing more fish out there. That's in the Channel Islands. Now, what's going to happen further north as we get into some of these colder water climates where fish take longer to grow? You know, we don't know yet. But, you know, the results from the channels are fairly encouraging, I would say.
So this is so much information. How is it going to affect how much fish is taken out of our waters? And are you going to continue to fish at the level that you have been?
Yeah, well, it's good. Both good questions. I think that we're going to come to a point of equilibrium in California. I think California, you know, California always overreaches, right? You know, somebody in Washington will say, let's have cars that do 35 miles a gallon, you know, on the highway, and California will be like, we're passing a law. 35 miles a gallon. You know, that's the way it is. And kind of that's what California did with fisheries. I think probably what's going to happen is some of these areas that you can reopen, like the federal closures, probably will start, some of it will start to get reopened and will come into an equilibrium. And I think we'll be at a nice point of stability in the commercial sector. Now, for me, you know, keep in mind, I'm a recreational fisherman. This is very different from a commercial fisherman. And I have found in my research over the years that I feel like recreational fishermen are not as receptive to regulation a lot of times as the commercial sector. Recreational fishermen are always sort of yelling about regulation. Oh, we don't do as much damage as the commercial guys. But surprise, you know, you park a recreational, what's called a party boat, you know, with 50, 60 patrons, park that over a reef, bait everybody's hookup and go down over a rockfish area, they can clear out that reef pretty quick. So, you know, for me, you know, I would like to kind of take a step back a little bit from my fishing Jones and try and figure out, you know, when I'm fishing, am I depleting or am I taking part in a, you know, well-regulated management regime where I can expect the same kind of fishing to occur next year? You know, because when you think about it, that's the definition of sustainability. Sustainability is basically, can we keep doing what we're doing and keep having the same resources year after year?
So great to talk to you, Paul.
Oh, really, really nice to be with you, Evan.
That was Paul Greenberg. His story for the California Sunday Magazine is titled The Fisherman's Dilemma. It was co-produced with the Food and Environment Reporting Network. You can hear Paul in conversation with some local fishermen and fisheries experts at Elysian next Friday, March 13th. The discussion starts at 5 p.m. It's free, but you need to RSVP. We've got a link with all the details on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. And now we are off to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where spring is in full swing. Laura Avery's there now with her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting today with Chef Wolfgang Puck. Now, he's a man who needs no introduction. He is a regular at the Farmers Market. And we were able to stop him today for a minute or two and ask him, Chef, what are you shopping for today?
Well, I'm shopping for the restaurants, but also for my home, because I want my family and my children and my wife eat really well. And, you know, it really starts with the ingredients. And that's why I love to come to the farmer's market. If it's right now, if it's green garlic or asparagus or great carrots. And, you know, my children are 8 and 9 years old and they love to eat vegetables. Why? Because since they are 1 year old, I always give them fresh vegetables and that's what they eat. So to me, the farmer's market is really the way I grew up in Europe. You know, we used to go every Saturday morning to the market and buy for Sunday lunch and then for the rest of the week. And I'm very happy. I saw over Andrea at Kenta Farms, who is probably, I know her for 35 years, and she's making bread like in Austria. And I have some friends coming from Austria today, actually. So when they're going to come over, they're going to be really surprised to have this amazing country bread.
Right. And she's also selling the flour, and it's exactly. Heritage grain, and it's wheat like they used to grow 100 years ago.
Exactly. I actually got some wheat berries, and I got some farro to have some salad, because my wife loves farro. So we're going to make a little salad with it and it, or add it to our salad. And the kids really love it, too, because it has this wonderful nutty flavor.
Right. And farro is a grain. Is it a wheat or is it a grain just in and of itself?
I think it looks like a grain to me, and you have to cook it like rice with lots of water or stock, you know, boil it. And it gets really a nutty flavor and has a lot of protein, so it's really amazing.
So what else goes into that salad?
Well, whatever is on the market. You know, if I find, I might get some artichokes, I might get some asparagus, they have some peas already, English peas, and obviously some carrots for color. So we mix it all together, just add a little bit of salt, fresh ground pepper, and a little bit of olive oil and balsamic vinegar.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And it's seasonal.
And it's seasonal, and it's very healthy, and everybody loves it because it tastes good, it tastes fresh. You know, it's not like people go to the supermarket and they buy the salads all mixed together already. And I always tell them, you know, that's all the leftovers, what you get, what we don't buy at the farmer's market.
Right. All right. All right, Chef. Well, thank you so much. It's always great to see you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
All right. That was Chef Wolfgang Puck, and he is a regular here at the farmer's market, and so great to finally catch up with him and hear what he's shopping for. The Farmers Market is happy to welcome the PGA to the market. Starting this week, the PGA, of course, is the Pixie Growers Association, which is a group of citrus farmers located in Ojai who were growing a very special small citrus fruit called the Pixie Tangerine. And I'm happy to be talking today to George Thatcher, who is a fifth-generation Ojai farmer. And his farm, Friends Ranch, is one of the farms that have joined together to promote this very special citrus variety called a Pixie Tangerine, and it's just coming into the markets now. So, George, tell us about the origin of the Pixie.
Well, the Ojai Pixie originally was created at UC Riverside back in 1929, and I can't remember the breeder's name, but it was created there as a seedless hybrid. And basically, he crossed two tangerine varieties and came up with the Ojai Pixie. It's believed he called it the Pixie because it's small in size, but what it packs inside is quite a punch. It's always seedless, it's easy to peel, and they're super sweet. They have a very low acid content, so when they come ripe in the late tangerine season, which would be now, around March or April, they are really sweet.
And why is it they're so special in Ojai?
We found that in growing the varietal that it is really hard to produce it anywhere else in California, or for that matter, anywhere on the planet that we know about. Ojai has something to it. There's something in the environment, the water, the terroir, if you want to call it that, that makes it special. It's got the best flavor, the best color. And it's just an Ojai thing.
Yeah.
It's a unique Ojai product.
So the Pixies we're getting here Wednesday, and you also go to the Sunday Hollywood Market. So these are right from your ranch picked when? Yesterday?
Yes, we had Carlos and Reyes picking yesterday. So our fruit is picked to order. We never warehouse stuff. It's picked and put in a box and put in a bag and sent to your house.
Great. And how long are we going to have the Pixies around?
Well, I expect the season to be extended probably through the summer into fall. I'm going to guess, and this is a guess, maybe September.
Okay. All right, George. Well, thanks so much. It's great to have the Pixies here.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate it.
That was George Thatcher, and he is a fifth-generation farmer from Ojai who's bringing in these tasty little Pixie tangerines, which you can enjoy now at the Wednesday Santa Monica and Sunday Hollywood Farmers Market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you aren't following us on Instagram yet, follow us at KCRW Good Food to find out what's in season each week. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen whenever you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who makes Good Food possible. Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.